This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, precipitous developments in regard to the situation in Syria, with the announcement today of the resignation of peace seeker and former Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan. Also reports today that President Barack Obama has indeed signed a finding or an executive order authorizing further direct United States intelligence coordination with the invaders of Syria under the name of the Free Syrian Army. We'll be speaking live with Ray McGovern, a former presidential briefer, to talk about the mechanics of how this covert escalation is taking place in and around Syria and Turkey and the Incirlik United States and NATO airbase, among other things. We are also standing by for a live report from the United Nations, where the Security Council is meeting at this hour. Also, we'll be speaking about Universal Peace Day on the commemoration of the bombing of Hiroshima. We'll be speaking with Suzanne about activities and bell ringings that will be taking place around the world. All that and more on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and there are many big things happening here, including the announcement from the Reuters news agency that there has, in fact, been a signing of an executive order for further covert intervention on the part of the United States against the nation of Syria. Reuters reports that President Barack Obama has signed a secret order authorizing U.S. support for rebels seeking to depose Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The order was approved earlier this year and is known as an intelligence finding and broadly permits the CIA and other United States agencies to provide support to the rebels. Reuters says that they do not know exactly when Obama signed such an intelligence authorization, and the spokesperson for the White House denied comment on the issue. In addition to that, there are reports that already the Syrian invaders who are being called rebels, who are supported by Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and elsewhere, many of them from Libya and other jihadi locations in the region, there are reports that they now have been armed with 24 surface-to-air missiles, perhaps anticipating an escalation there with the ability to shoot down fighter bombers or helicopters or other aerial vehicles of the Syrian government. These are very serious developments, and to help decode them, we are now joined live by Ray McGovern, a former Central Intelligence Agency officer who worked in the White House as a presidential daily briefer. And Ray, since we last spoke, these are some monumental developments, in my opinion. The resignation of Kofi Annan and the possible loss of the United Nations as a peace-seeking body, if indeed that is what its mission has been, and the executive order or the presidential finding. Let's begin with the mechanics of how a president initiates covert activities like this. Can you tell us how this works?
Sure. Going back to the founding of the agency, that is the CIA, in 1947, the legislation indicated that this should be a body of experts to collect, assess, and report to the president what was going on in the world without fear or favor, you know, the traditional speak truth to power. Now, by an accident of history, when the OSS spies and overturners of governments came back from World War II to great applause, they said, well, do you still need us? Or should we go back to our, you know, to our corporations, our law firms, go back to academe? Do you still need us around? And the answer came very quickly, of course. The Soviet Union had taken over Eastern Europe. The KGB, the Soviet secret police, was all over the world. And so the answer was, of course we need you. Hang around. And then some idiot, and I use the term advisedly, some idiot said, hey, I know where we can put these guys. We're creating this other agency. Truman's got it. It's his baby. He wants secret information to help inform policy decisions. Let's put these operators in together with the analysts. Now, that was a really, really dumb move for lots of reasons, which I won't go into right now. But it was justified by one sentence inserted into the middle of the National Security Act of 1947, which says, the Director of Central Intelligence shall, perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence that the president shall from time to time direct. Now, that's a pretty broad authorization there. If you have a unscrupulous president and an obliging, let's say, or a malleable director of central intelligence, you know what you can do? You can wind up doing things like torture or creating black prisons or kidnapping people or actually authorizing eavesdropping without a judicial warrant. You can do all those things. And the only check on that, Robert, and this is the key thing, the only check on that are the so-called oversight committees of the Congress. Now, since 9/11, those oversight committees, that's a misnomer. They should be called the overlook committees, because everyone is so afraid of appearing to be less than 110% against terrorism, that just as in 30 years ago, the old days, no one could afford to appear to be anything less than 110% against communists, these people in the oversight committees prefer not to be told chapter and verse about what's going on. They're sort of just a kind of a conduit, a signature on a finding, which the president really has to sign, so that the money that they need can be appropriated by the appropriators in the Congress. Long answer to your question, but this has never worked very well. If you have an honest president and a good director of Central Intelligence, or now director of National Intelligence, then it has a chance of working. But in the current atmosphere, in this highly politicized, especially in an election year atmosphere, I can see Obama relishing the notion of leaking to the press, as he just undoubtedly did. We have a finding now, and we're going to use our CIA as well as our armed forces to help these rebels against this terrible regime in Damascus. Is the regime in Damascus terrible? Yes, it is. But is it? What are the chances that these rebels can succeed against it? Less than 20%, as far as I'm concerned. So what we're in for, if this rebel army is stoked up, if it's given weapons and you know the shades of what we did in Afghanistan and the blowback from that just leap out at today's news that we're giving them shoulder-fired SAM missiles, surface-to-air missiles. That's what we gave to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They knocked out a bunch of Soviet planes, but a lot of those Stinger missiles are still around, and they may have won the. They may have helped drive the Soviets out, but there's lots of problems attending the provision of this kind of sophisticated or even unsophisticated. As long as it's a surface-to-air missile, you've got real problems. So I see nothing but more trouble ahead. I don't understand really where Hillary Clinton and those that support her policy, which is, quote, Assad must go, end quote. When you ask for unconditional surrender, when you don't allow any leeway for a really, truly diplomatic solution, then, you're aiding and abetting a war that's going on for years. And that, in my view, is why Kofi Annan quit. They wouldn't let him rope in some of the other stakeholders in the area, like Iran. And they wouldn't cease and desist subverting the government by providing all manner of support. Up until now, it's been, communications equipment and things that are non-lethal. I would not think it very long before the finding is amended to include lethal ammunition and other things for this ragtag group, some of whom we know are al-Qaeda types. So they're talking about flashback or talking about blowback. We help arm some al-Qaeda types to take over or share the power in Syria. That's going to come back to bite us really bad right in our behind. So it's a bad idea. It's distressing news. And you're right to call attention to it, because Americans really don't appreciate what this really means.
The executive order, or the presidential finding, I suppose, might be a bit more precise, is for clandestine aid to the so-called Syrian rebels. It's my understanding, and perhaps you can help us with this, you refer to an amendment. By that, would you mean a memorandum of notification in the event that weapons were explicitly being sent by the president and the intelligence agencies to the invaders of Syria? And I'd like for you to help us understand the detail of how that works, and then put it in the context of the fact that they are being supplied by weapons in any case through the cutout agency of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO is doing this in Adana, in Cyrillic Air Base, and so on. I mean, we understand that the provision of weapons and other supplies is moot, but how does this concept of a memorandum of notification modify the process?
Well, this has to do with the finding, and the finding is a legalism here. It started, 22 years ago now, 1991, with the Intelligence Authorization Act then. It specified that the CIA must have a presidential finding signed by the president in order to conduct these so-called covert activities. And so since then, if the president, the White House, wants something done, in this case funding, in this case perhaps later arming rebels, he's got to have the money to do that. And the procedure in the Congress establishes that he's got to sign this thing saying, yes, it's necessary for our national security to help these rebels give trouble to the Assad regime in Syria. Now, the Reuters report today, and I don't know a lot more than what I read there, specifies that weapons are not yet completely included. I would think this is a slippery slope as night follows the day. I would think that their weapons would be included shortly, and that would require a simple amendment. Now, again, the people, quote, supervising, end quote, all this are people in Congress who have traditionally simply winked, even on matters of torture, you know. Let me explain what happens here. The fellows there, and they're almost all fellows, the old boys at Langley, they come down to the Congress and they say, well, we've got to go into the secret room. Now, remember, everything in this room is classified. You're not to breathe a word about what we're saying outside this room, right? Okay, if you can't do that, then don't come in the room. Well, everybody wants to come in a room, find out what's going on, right? Well, they start talking as they did with Nancy Pelosi, who has the longest tenure of anyone on the House Intelligence Committee. They started talking about torture and stuff. And of course, later she said, well, I didn't know anything about this torture. And so you know what they do? They bring down the memorandum of conversation. They say, Miss Pelosi, please, don't you remember that on June 3rd, 2004, we briefed you on not only on torture, but some of the methods being used. And actually, we have it right here in this memorandum of conversation. So maybe you ought not to, say you didn't know about it. Now, where the truth lies in all that stuff is anybody's guess. But it's the MO, the modus operandi, where you either co-opt the committee, quote, supervisors, end quote, or you, you kind of blackmail them. You kind of dig up a memo which, quote, shows, end quote, that they knew chapter and verse. Now, in the atmosphere of today, where, you know, everything and anything is okay in this war against terrorism, politicians want to avoid, like the plague, saying no to anything that the president or the CIA wants to do. What does the CIA do? Well, that's what we do. We do regime change. We do stuff. We help people do regime change. That's what we do. And so President Obama doesn't have the maturity or the senior advisors or any adults around that could say, well, Mr. President, this is what we did in 1953 to overthrow the Iranian duly elected government. this is what we did in Guatemala in 1954, because Guatemalans wanted to give their land to the peasants and United Fruit didn't want that. This is what we do regularly, and it never comes out really well for the people. Maybe we ought to knock it off this time. Maybe we ought to let the Syrians sort out their own affairs and make sure that everyone in the area, including Iran, the stakeholders get together and they figure out a way to make a peaceful settlement of this before there are years, and I'm talking years, of violence tantamount to civil war.
Ray McGovern, there is another element to the way clandestine operations against nations emanate from the executive branch and related agencies, and that is the cutout. We spoke about NATO as being a cutout in the supplying of weapons, armaments, and I suspect increasingly as we go forward with drones and intel and so-called secure communications devices, which might go a long way, along with the special forces training that clearly these ragtag so-called rebels have gotten for their surprising effectiveness in Aleppo and elsewhere. But there's another way, a different cutout, inside the United States government, and I suspect that the State Department might be involved in the clandestine operations in support of the rebels, or the so-called rebels, since we know that there's nearly $100 million that the State Department has allocated for these people, and $25 million of it or so is supposedly tagged as, quote, non-lethal, quote, assistance, and the rest of it as, quote, humanitarian, quote, assistance. Can you parse the meaning of these terms legally and procedurally? In particular, how is a distinction made between lethal and non-lethal? Because a pencil can be considered a lethal or a non-lethal object, and a weapon can be used to batter down a door in the case of fire. So how is this distinction made?
Well, it has to do with the time-honored concept of, quote, plausible deniability, okay, end quote. That's what the legislation actually even talks about. A covert action is supposed to be an operation that gives the president and any other officialdom plausible denial. In other words, they can pretend not to be aware of it. Now, you can see how silly that is when reports come out with respect to Iraq, for example, or with respect to Iran. Let's take Iran. We know that toward the end of his administration, George Bush and Dick Cheney earmarked $40 million to subvert, well, we don't say subvert anymore, we don't say overthrow anymore, for regime change in Iran, okay? Now, we know that money was appropriated, and we know it's intended use, but still, people claim that, well, we can still have a plausible deniability about that because we don't know exactly what the operations are. So similarly here, you're going to have overt funds supervised by the State Department, $100 million you mentioned for bandages and for communications activity and so forth. Well, that's a small portion of what undoubtedly is going to be appropriated now under this finding. And unless somebody leaks how much money the finding is authorizing, then we'll never know. Chances are someone will leak because, you know, some of these leaks are officially condoned as a way of showing how tough, how rough and tough our president is, how he's going to do just about everything that he can to employ the CIA as well as the armed forces in this fight on terrorism. One other thing here, which is very, very troublesome. We talked about the finding and what's necessary to fund these covert action CIA activities, which are supposed to have plausible denial. Now, there's a whole slew of other activities done by our special forces under the Pentagon, which does not have to have a finding, and which reports to a separate committee in the Congress. And so you have the Senate Armed Services Committee, quote, supervising, end quote, the clandestine activities of the special forces operations, and we have the Senate Intelligence Committee supervising, in quotes, the activity of the CIA clandestine operations. And guess what? They don't talk to each other. They're not cleared for each other's activities. And so people that I know who worked on these staffs don't know what the other staff is doing, and they're not allowed to find out. So you have a very, very messy situation here where, in my view, the president's throwing all his assets at this ostensible problem of terrorism and now Assad. The right hand literally doesn't know what the left hand is doing, but they're doing a lot of stuff, and that's what we do. We do regime change.
Our guest is Ray McGovern, and he is a former Central Intelligence Agency officer and responsible for presidential daily intelligence briefings through four different administrations, if I recall correctly, Ray. You were speaking about the Pentagon and the military side to this full court press against Syria. And I remember, as I believe you do too, the Contra Wars of Central America and the close liaising between United States military bases and trainers in places like El Salvador, or San Pedro Sula, Honduras, and elsewhere throughout the region. Could you tell us if there are permanent tactics of military training and assistance for Contra forces, the Contras of Syria today, and what kind of interaction there might be between American special forces and these invaders of Syria?
Well, you can be sure that not only the CIA and its assets in the area, but that the special forces under Admiral McRaven are actually very busy in that area. How they conduct liaison together is a problem. And when you have a four-star admiral, McRaven, or maybe he's only got three, that's a lot. And that will dwarf in significance any CIA station chief out that way. So what we have here is really an example of how things can go wrong. Now, what am I talking about? I'm talking about a op-ed that President Harry S. Truman put in the Washington Post on the 22nd of December, 1963. That was 1 month after the assassination of John Kennedy. And Harry Truman composed this, we have his notes from the Truman Library, deliberately as soon as he heard that the president had been assassinated. The title of this op-ed was Limit CIA Role to Intelligence. Now, he wrote, quote, "I am disturbed by the way the CIA has been diverted from its original assignment." He called outright for CIA's, quote, "operational duties to be terminated or properly used elsewhere." He said, "This is not what I intended for this agency." Now, there are a lot of us, including me, who believe that the timing is not insignificant, that Truman knew how people could be mousetrapped and even how people could be assassinated. And if you look in some of the other papers that have been revealed by various authors and so forth, you can see that Alan Dulles, who was the first real head of the CIA, mousetrapped John Kennedy with a covert action program approved by Eisenhower, Kennedy's predecessor, to do the Bay of Pigs operation on false pretenses. They said, "Mr. Kennedy, we have these great troops. They're most of them Cuban exiles. They're going to land on the Bay of Pigs, sure, and just going to come in. There's going to be an uprising throughout the island, and we'll depose Castro." And Kennedy said, "Well, that sounds pretty ambitious to me, but just remember, I'm not going to commit any U.S. forces to an operation like this. If you guys think you can do this, go ahead. I know that Eisenhower already proved that, so you go ahead, but remember, I am not going to send the U.S. military to rescue you if you need it. Now, in the coffee-stained notes in Alan Dulles' study, he writes that the president will feel forced politically to send in air power and perhaps even ground troops to help this operation success. So they knew. They knew beforehand that this would never succeed with this ragtag group, but they thought that once they landed them on the beach, that Kennedy would be forced politically to say, oh, okay, send in the Army, send in the Air Force. And he stuck to his guns, and that's why, shortly after that, he was quoted as saying, I want to tear the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He sacked Alan Dulles, and guess who became the chief of staff of the Warren Commission investigating the assassination of John F. Kennedy? It was Alan Dulles. And when President Truman wrote this op-ed 1 month after Kennedy was assassinated, there were a lot of people who were speculating that maybe the CIA had something to do with this, okay? And so what happened was, and this is really, really unique, that op-ed appeared in the first edition of the Washington Post on December 22nd, 1963. But you know what? It didn't appear in the second or the third edition. There used to be three in those. So this is remarkable. Somebody thought, well, I'm going to pull it out of there. And guess what? It got no media attention anywhere else in the world except for a small paper in Independence, Missouri. Okay? Now, what did Truman... What did Alan Dulles also do? Well, he went out to Independence, Missouri, on the pretext that he was giving a speech in Kansas City. And he said, Mr. Truman, just on one-on-one, he said, did you know about this op-ed? And we only have Alan Dulles' account. But what he said in a memorandum that he put in the CIA files was this. When I showed President Truman what the Washington Post put under his name, he said, oh, I never intended that. Oh, no, that's completely wrong. Now, what am I saying here? I'm saying that Alan Dulles ran an operation on the former president. The former president died shortly thereafter, but Alan Dulles inserted this official memorandum into the CIA file supervised by one of his old cronies, Larry Houston. And so if somebody raised that while Truman was running the Warren Commission, was CIA involved in all this? What about this Truman op-ed? That's really bizarre. He said, oh, we had that covered. Larry Houston, bring that memo down. See, I talked to the president, former president, and he disavowed all that. Now, how do we know that's a lie? Well, we know that's a lie because 2 months after that one-on-one between Alan Dulles and former President Truman, Truman was asked by Look magazine, well, what about this? Do you still assert what you said in that 22 December 1963 op-ed? He said, of course I do. The CIA shouldn't be involved in this kind of thing. And it's a great, great embarrassment, a great disappointment to see what I set up as a think tank to collect, process, and report what's really going on in the world, what it's evolved into. And it should be stopped. Those activities should be stopped by the CIA. If they want to put them somewhere else, that's what they should do. So what we have is Alan Dulles orchestrating not only the Warren Commission, but covering his tracks, trying to make this op-ed completely disappear rather than just the last two editions of it, if you follow me. And that's what Truman had in mind. And I respect Harry Truman for writing that thing and for warning us all that if you have unmonitored, unbridled, and unsupervised activities justified by one sentence in the National Security Act of 1947, you got trouble deep. You may have assassinations, you may have torture, you may have black prisons, you may have kidnapping, you may have all manner of crazy things going on, not only in places like the Soviet Union, but in places like Iran, Iraq, you know, you name it, these people do what they do. And what they do now, we say, of course, is regime change.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are speaking with what news agencies might refer to as a knowledgeable source in the person of Ray McGovern, a former CIA officer, intelligence analyst, and daily presidential briefer. And Ray, I'd like to return to a point that we touched on this occasion, where there seems to be a monumental escalation against Syria taking place. And that is, as a final question in the remaining minutes here, we spoke about the shoulder-fired missiles that are being supplied to the invaders of Syria. And that certainly obviously poses a risk to civilians, civilian aircraft, as well as that which is of the government. And that bothers me because there is a push at the United Nations to create a so-called safe zone in northern Syria near the Turkish border on the way from Adana to Aleppo. And the establishment of a safe zone somehow haunts me. In the same way the United Nations authorized a so-called no-fly zone in northern Iraq, and NATO and the United States stepped in and terrorized the nation from the air. And do you have any concerns that a so-called pleasant-sounding safe zone could be a trigger for explicit military intervention by the United States and or NATO in Syria?
Well, the big difference here between Libya and Syria is geography. And as an old Russian analyst, I have to tell you that the Soviet Union and now Russia feels very, very strongly about what happens in its near frontier. Now, Syria is much closer to the Soviet Union, of course, and Syria has been a traditional, well, not ally, but friend of the Soviet Union and Russia, and recipient of military as well as economic aid. The Russians, in this case, are not only not going to approve things in the UN, but they're not going to stand by idly and watch Assad be removed by folks that the Russians don't know who they are either. And, you know, they have their own problems with terrorism and Al-Qaeda and Chechnya and stuff like that. So they're not about to watch this thing as they acquiesced in watching Libya. Most people consider that the Chinese and the Russians were conned on Libya, that they were given undertakings by the West that, no, this is just to protect those folks out there in Benghazi. Once we prevent them from being gunned down by the Libyans, that'll be it, you know, and you can see what happened in Libya. So, you know, fool me once, okay, they're not going to be fooled again. The more so. So what we're talking more so in their near frontier area. So what we're talking about here is a very volatile situation where you could actually get, you know, if there were a, what are they calling it, a free zone or a spacey zone? Sounds spacey, doesn't it? Space zone. I think in the first instance, the Syrians are going to be able to take care of that because they have a military that's much more competent and much more sophisticated than the Libyans had. And if they can't, well, you'll have the Soviet Union, or the Russia in this case. I say Soviet Union because this is what happened in Vietnam, of course. The Russians did come in, provide SAMs, okay, surface-to-air missiles to Hanoi. And they have very little to lose because that's their neighborhood.
Well, we'll be watching that very closely, and we're very grateful for the comprehensive insight you have provided on the intelligence mechanics of the ongoing attempt to invade and overthrow the government in Syria. We've been speaking with Ray McGovern. His website is raymondmcgovern.com. And he is the author, most recently, of an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun and other newspapers across the country in regard to the escalation of hostilities against Syria and then perhaps ultimately Iran. Thank you, Ray.
You're most welcome.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we have been standing by for the conclusion of a Security Council meeting where Matthew Lee of the Inner City Press has been monitoring things. And Matthew, we've been speaking about the resignation of Kofi Annan. We've been speaking about the secret finding of the President of the United States, Barack Obama, in regard to aiding the combatants inside the country. What is the latest that you have from the United Nations at this hour?
Sure. Thanks a lot, Bob. They just finished the Security Council meeting basically to talk about the future, if any, of the UN observer mission in Syria. Seems like it probably won't be extended, at least as it currently is. There were afterwards, the Russian ambassador spoke, and then the French ambassador spoke, and the head of peacekeeping. And ironically, it's the Russians in this case that are saying they would like the mission to be continued. And it's the Western side, represented in this case by France, saying that they see no reason for it to continue, that Kofi Annan quit because of the vetoes of Russia and China. So things are looking pretty divided.
The resignation means that other nations have been impeded from taking part in a regional peace process among stakeholders. Is that the take that you have on it?
No, I mean, I guess there's no question that there was a sort of a split. You know, Kofi Annan was quoted publicly as saying that, for example, Iran should be invited to this Geneva conference that was on June 30th. And my understanding is that the United States and Hillary Clinton said they wouldn't attend if Iran was invited. I think it's the strange thing here is that when he first began, Kofi Annan, you know, he's pretty, among many other qualities that he has, positive and negative, he's very adept at sort of splitting the difference between the Eastern and Western sides. And so I really do think when he began, he had the support of all five permanent members. I think as time went on, you started hearing more positive things from Russia and China, and more negative things from the Western side. They just thought that he was sort of buying Assad time, that there was no... I'm not really sure what they... It wasn't clear to me what they expected him to be able to do, if in fact, the rebels are armed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia. It was a very difficult job, and he basically quit finding that he couldn't do it.
There's another issue. We just a moment ago spoke with Ray McGovern about this. It's a question that... troubles me, whether there can be, out of the United Nations and the Security Council, an initiative to create what is being benevolently called a safe zone after the external forces have actually created an unsafe nation inside Syria. And do you think my instinct is on or off in regard to this being one of many avenues in which a military intervention, a no-fly zone, an escalation of external forces in Syria can be exercised in the name of protecting the people?
Yeah, I think that the first country I heard speaking about it was Turkey. And also you had France. You know, they sort of like this... it's a concept that has some history to it. I don't think if in all cases that it would be a bad idea. I think here it clearly would be a way to say, you know, international military forces are protecting this area. I think, you know, probably the most determinative. Yesterday, the EU's own humanitarian commissioner, Kristalina Georgieva, was here in New York. So I went to her press conference, and she's asked, you know, whether she thinks that humanitarian corridors are a good idea, and she said she does not, there'd be no way to make sure that weapons weren't trafficked through them. So I don't really see that idea as I mean, I think I can imagine it being the I don't want to say the pretext, the sort of brand name under which, for example, I mean, I think something that a lot of people don't talk about is Turkey has a very big interest in the, you know, the Kurdish parts of Syria not becoming de facto autonomous. So you can imagine, yeah, I mean, if you start hearing about a Turkish humanitarian corridor to the area that they don't want to assert autonomy, then you can rest assured it's not really a humanitarian corridor, but an anti-separatist corridor that they're setting up. So I think that's, it really is going to be interesting between now and the middle of August to see, you know, I mean, I think, I guess the way I look on it is this, is like the U.S., I think the Obama administration basically, like, wants this problem to go away until the election. And you have the UK and France, as much as they want to kill off the mission, their main power in the world currently, politically and diplomatically, is through the Security Council. So once the Security Council is out of this game, they have a big problem.
One final question, and we certainly appreciate your being here at the very moment of the conclusion of the Security Council session today, Matthew
Sure.
Lee of Inner City Press. And that is, how can there be discussions at the United Nations without the full and explicit acknowledgement of the thorough involvement of NATO and of Incirlik and Adana, and does the circumlocution of these very real interventions against Syria, is diplomacy possible with the denial or the evasion of these facts on the ground?
No, that's, I mean, but I'll give you an example, and this is turning to, you know, tomorrow's news today. The discussion does go on at the UN. Tomorrow there's going to be a vote in the General Assembly on a resolution drafted by Saudi Arabia, which has been watered down somewhat, but very much directed at endorsing the Arab League positions. And it initially called for a side to step down. Now it doesn't, but it's probably going to pass with over 100 votes. And then people are going to say this is the will of the international community. The irony is that, like, Saudi Arabia is pretty openly violating the Kofi Annan 6-point plan by arming the rebels. So it's, I mean, at the UN, anything is possible. Anyone can say anything while doing something else. I mean, maybe you're referring to real diplomacy. I think it's getting more and more unlikely here in terms of, like, an honest discussion among people saying, here's what we're doing. But I think, it's highly ironic that Saudi Arabia is the sponsor of this resolution tomorrow, given its role in, again, be who you are. Like, if you really, the question is, why are they arming the opposition? Is it really because they're committed to democracy? So, you know, or is it because they see a strategic opportunity to, you know, cut off Iran from the Gulf and defend, it from their point of view, Bahrain, stuff like that? But there will be a vote tomorrow at the UN, so the talking never ceases.
Well, thank you so much for your clarity and sharpness today, reporting live from the United Nations, Matthew Lee of Intercity Press. And we'll stay in touch as this develops, and we recommend that people follow your and your colleagues' work at the website intercitypress.com. Thank you once again, Matthew.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And just to recap, there are reports today of the signing of a presidential finding by Barack Obama in regard to further clandestine intervention against the nation of Syria. And also today, former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced his resignation at the end of this month in regard to his peace-seeking efforts in and around Syria. This is what it sounded like when he quit today.
5 months ago, I was asked to take on the role of Joint Special Envoy for Syria in order to seek peaceful solution to the crisis, an end to the killings of civilians, the human rights abuses, and a path towards a political transition. I accepted this task, which some called Mission Impossible, for I believed it was a sacred duty to do whatever was in my power to help the Syrian people find a peaceful solution to this bloody conflict. The severity of the humanitarian cost of the conflict and the exceptional threats posed by this crisis to international peace and security justify the attempts to secure a peaceful transition to a political settlement, however daunting the challenge. The increasing militarization on the ground and the clear lack of unity in the Security Council have fundamentally changed the circumstances for the effective exercise of my role.
The sound of former Secretary General Kofi Annan today announcing his resignation from the peace-seeking effort in regard to Syria. In addition to that, there is a most curious statement that was made in conjunction with that intended resignation from the current Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, after announcing the details of the procedures of the non-renewal of the contract as of 31 August 2012. Ban Ki-moon made the following curious statement. He said, quote, Kofi Annan deserves our profound admiration for the selfless way in which he has put his formidable skills and prestige to this most difficult and potentially thankless of assignments, end quote. For the Secretary General to say a thankless assignment would seem to indicate a sense of predictive pessimism about the United Nations' ability to actually support peace instead of clandestine interventions in this world. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We're on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. And we turn from the escalation of war to an effort of peace in the Universal Peace Day. And we're now joined by Sue Zinn. And this is something that is done every year on the anniversary of the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima. Welcome back to 5 o'clock Shadow, Sue Zinn.
Oh, thank you, Robert. Thank you for all your years of supporting us and really holding the vision of peace, listening to your program. Just my heart goes out to just all the war that goes on all over this world. And, you know, we, you know, the truth of the matter is we all want peace, and yet somehow it's very challenging, isn't it? And so we are, we do an annual event, and each year we commemorate the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, and our goal is to transform the memory of a horrific event into a transformation into peace and life. And this year we're going to be at Union Square Park by the Gandhi statue, which I feel is real appropriate to be by Gandhi, a great peacemaker of our world. And we're going to be ringing bells around the world. It's actually a clarion call. We started this project 5 years ago to ring bells around the world. It's called the Peel for Peace Bell Project. And I'm actually thrilled because this year the World Peace Association from Japan, which has actually installed over 20 peace bells around the world, are participating with us. So we're going to be having bells ringing literally around the world this year, of course, including Japan, which has over the years has been a big participant of ours. But this year it will be in New Zealand and Australia and Mexico and around around the U.S. I've been getting all kinds of emails from people telling me they're ringing bells. The Riverside Church, which we've done Universal Peace Day about a number of years, and for the last 5 years they have been ringing their bells, and they're going to be doing it this year, as well as St. John the Divine.
This is taking place across the United Nations and around the world, of course, as you mentioned. How can various communities take part in this?
Well, you know, the idea is come out and ring bells. You know, contact your churches, your anywhere, your, maybe your colleges that have bells, or just gather your friends and ring bells and just say, you know, we want peace and we want a world without war. I mean, it's, you know, I felt so inspired by the Occupy Wall Street and, you know, the people really coming out and standing up for, you know, our rights. And we're not asking for much right now. We're just asking to be heard and to stand up for peace. It was interesting. A few years ago, I was in Argentina, and there was all kinds of unrest, and people were going out with their pots and pans, and they were just banging on the pots and, you know, demanding for the president to, you know, turn around what she had, you know, her rights that she had wanted to make changes there. And yet I feel this certain complacency that we feel is in this country, at least. We're seeing around the world people are coming out. So this idea here is really can be just a very small thing with your friends. You're coming out and ringing bells. You're gathering in places. You can, you know, obviously come to Union Square. We're starting at 5 o'clock. We're going to be having a song and poetry and visions of peace. And then at 7:15, which is the exact moment of the bombing, it's actually 7:15 August 5th here and 8:15 a.m. August 5th.
That's 7:15 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which would be, of course, at 4:15 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time for those who might be listening elsewhere across the country. And
exactly.
That's for Hiroshima, and Nagasaki would be at 10:02 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time and 7:02 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time
on August 8th.
August 8th.
And,
8th,
yes,
here.
And want to thank you for including them, because when we're ringing our bells, we're including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That is really, I've been to both places numerous times, and I've met so many survivors.
It's a great piece of work that you're doing, and I think we'll all spiritually be with you on that. And in the minute that we have remaining, tell people how they can be in touch and take part in this.
Oh, great. So we have a website called UniversalPeaceDay.com. We also have a Facebook, Facebook/ringbells and the number 4 peace. And anyone could contact me through ringbellsforpeace@gmail.com. And I would love for people to send us their photos and their videos and posts, what they've been doing.
The website would be UniversalPeaceDay.com.
Yes.
UniversalPeaceDay.com. Thank you so much for being with us today, Suzanne.
Thank you, Robert, for all your support. I hope to see you on Sunday.
Bringing the harmony of peace to the world. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. That was produced with Thiago Peroso and engineered by Joyce Jones. And we welcome your comments, tips, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. Thanks also today to Matthew Lee and Ray McGovern for insights on the breaking events in regard to Syria. For 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.